From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum in this morning's opening hour, we focus our attention once again on climate change in light of a new and alarming international report, which we'll discuss in the first half hour with Tim Flannery, Australia's Chief Commissioner for Climate Change. Then, after the 9:30 break, we talk to representatives of SPUR, the San Francisco Planning and Urban Research Association, about a report they're releasing called Climate Change Hits Home. It addresses effects of climate change locally, and it presents a future plan of action. Forum is next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Drawing on new research, an international report from the Oslo-based Arctic Monitoring and Assessment Program, backed by the Eight-Nation Arctic Council, will be delivered next week in Greenland and discussed by 400 international scientists at a conference in Copenhagen. The report concludes that climate change is taking place in the Arctic at a faster pace than was previously believed. The melting ice could conceivably, according to the report, elevate the global sea level by as much as 5 feet in the present century. I want to talk about the report and climate change in this opening forum segment with writer, environmentalist, and Australia's Chief Commissioner for Climate Change, Tim Flannery, who now chairs the Sea Coastal Australian team. He's also director of the Australian Wildlife Conservancy, and his books include Weathermaker and most recently Here on Earth, A Natural History of the Planet. He joins us in studio. Good to have you with us.
It's great to be here, Michael. Thank you.
Well, let's begin by talking about what we can deduce from this report. And I should mention by way of introduction, just for listeners' sake, that what we're talking about here is something which confirms what we've been known for at least 6 years, warmest Arctic over the last 6 years ever been recorded. Sea level is definitely rising, but it's rising faster than we thought it was, right?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, this is bad news and it needs to be taken seriously. The work that's been done up to now by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change has really only factored in the rate of sea level rise that will occur as heat transfers from the atmosphere into the oceans. And that, you know, it's called thermal expansion. Hot water takes up more space than cold water. So that will account for about, I don't know, a foot and a half maybe of sea level rise up to the end of the century. But this new 5 foot figure is really worrying. And what it's doing is factoring in the ice melt, projected ice melt for places like Greenland and other major ice caps. Now, that work is difficult to do. The reason the IPCC didn't try to model it is it is complex and difficult to do, but this new group, the eight nations in the Arctic Agreement area, have made an attempt, and what they've discovered is of grave concern.
And we know that the Arctic Ocean is nearly going to be ice-free, according to this report, in 30, 40 years. And this is done through what kind of projections? I mean, the analysis uses, we're told, the most recent scientific techniques and the most recent scientific type of analysis, but what's different here?
Well, what people have been able to do now is look at the thickness of the ice and measure that across the Arctic, because the thickness of the ice is a very important indicator as well of when it's going to disappear. It's been realised that much of the ice now across the Arctic Ocean is thin ice, it's newly formed ice, and it can melt away very quickly. So the new projections with this understanding suggest that, you know, maybe in the next 5 years we may see an ice-free
serious threat to polar bears and all those other species, notwithstanding all the threat to global warming. And when we're talking about global warming, of course, there are still the non-believers, but we're talking about something that, if anything, in light of these new findings, suggests more necessity of combating it and finding a way to combat it. And here we have this attempt at a UN Global Pact, which has been going pretty snail pace, hasn't it?
It's been going slowly, but we are making progress. The Copenhagen Accord that came out of the Copenhagen meeting is actually looking now to be quite a good first step. You know, we've got 80% of the emissions corralled under that accord. Countries have pledged for certain emissions reductions. So for example, the USA has pledged for a 17% emissions reduction below 2005 level by 2020. And you're actually on the way to achieving that. You're at about minus 9% now. Part of that's courtesy of the economic slowdown, but there are also good policies in place that are starting to bite now.
Yeah, you're one of those who's somewhat sanguine about what came out of Copenhagen. A lot of people were very distressed about it, felt it hadn't gone far enough, particularly with the emerging nations, particularly China and specifically China, but even more so other emerging nations, Brazil, etc.
Well, Michael, I chaired the Copenhagen Climate Council for 3 years and saw that process pretty close up. And, we knew a year before the meeting there wasn't going to be a global treaty. Now, a lot of people didn't want to hear that, and their expectations remained high right up to the very end and then crashed when we didn't get the global treaty. What we did get was the accord. Yeah, it's a non-binding agreement, but, you know, a global treaty is really binding. Is, you know, are the blue helmets going to go into Canada when they default on the Kyoto Protocol? I don't think so. But, you know, so it's a good start. It gets us about two-thirds of the emissions we need if everyone honours their pledges to avoid dangerous climate change. But that's only the very first step in a long road. This issue is going to be with us for decades. We'll be doing this battle for a long time yet.
Well, and it's an issue that certainly concerns our listeners. So many of them may indeed want to join us. So let me give out the number early now, because those of you listening have an opportunity to join this program with questions or comments, and we invite you to do so. This is a half-hour segment we have with Tim Flannery. And again, his new book is called Here on Earth, A Natural History of the Planet. If you would like to be part of this program, you're able to do that right now. Toll-free number, 866-733-6786. Opportunity to speak with us not only about this new report that's come out, but also about concerns you may have where climate change is. We're going to be talking in the second half hour with representatives from SPUR about a local report that they've put out. In the meantime, the phone lines are available. It's 866-733-6786. The time to call is now. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or you can post a question or comment immediately on our website, kqed.org/forum, and simply click on this segment. The melting of the polar region ice that is really so of concern that we began talking about here, this is particularly of concern to coastal regions, low-altitude coastal regions. We're talking about really from Bangladesh to Florida, aren't we?
Oh, yeah, all along the American coast. The east coast of the U.S. is very vulnerable. And just to give you an idea of how things may unfold, even if we assume that sea levels are only going to rise by 1.5 feet this century, what that does is take a once-in-a-century inundation event due to high tides and storms and so forth under the old sea level and turns it into an event you may see once a month or 10 times a month, yeah? Because you've shifted the bell curve so that the average is now laying over that very long tail, what was once a rare event. So this is serious. 1.5 feet is serious enough. 5 feet I find incomprehensible. You know, in my own country of Australia, we know that you know, a 3 foot rise in sea level will endanger 250,000 houses, critical infrastructure such as rail, airports, roads, that sort of thing. The cost is enormously high. And so we're trying to plan now for this eventuality, because the ocean is a juggernaut. Once it starts to rise, there is nothing we can do.
You're talking about the New York subway system being flooded, for example. I mean, these kind of projections.
That'll be the least of your problems.
Well, it sounds so doomsday. People can't really get their minds around it, doesn't it?
I know. It is truly horrifying, because it's one of those things that, you know, the oceans are 500 times bigger than the atmosphere, yeah? When they start to move, there's little humanity can do to slow that down, because the heat transfer will just continue on. We've got to cut the emissions, but we've also got to face the fact that we are going to have to adapt to this rising sea, and that is going to be pricey. We need to start now with a full integration of regulation from the city level through to the federal level to make sure we're not just building in more liability by building more coastal communities. And we need to start strategically planning for infrastructure shifts that will allow people to allow us to continue to have roads, rail and airports into the future.
One thinks about the horror that Japan went through with the tsunami and how much more worse that could be down the line, doesn't one?
Well, it does. As I said, once you raise the sea level, any flooding event becomes much, much more common and more damaging.
Talking again with Tim Flannery, and let me go to your calls here. Let's begin, Colin, with you. Good morning.
Good morning. You mentioned that the energy consumption in the U.S. is down because of the recession. That's not going to last forever. What are the measures that the U.S. government would need to take and explain to its own taxpayers to address climate change? Is it cap and trade, which doesn't seem to have gotten very far? Is it increased gas tax?
Well, it's look, the answer is all of the above. We have to start with a foundation stone for this activity, and that is an emissions trading scheme. Now, thankfully, California is going to be pioneering that this year.
We're pretty far ahead of the curve here, actually.
You are. You are carrying a good bit of the burden, and therefore garnering the benefits too of this increased innovation, which is fantastic to see. But you do need a national approach to this. You've got a national target. It has to be honoured by the federal government. And what the government's been able to do, despite the great opposition in the Congress to even acknowledging that climate change is real, is really dealing with energy security issues, particularly in the transport sector, that everyone can agree are common sense and good. So the new CAFE standards are part of that. There'll be additional work done in that transport area that'll help reduce emissions. If the EPA can regulate, even though it's not the most cost-effective option available, regulate, say, fuel efficiency standards for new coal-fired power plants and so forth, that'll help as well. But, you know, we need to take a federal approach on this, and we need to get very serious about it, because the rest of the world is moving. To be honest with you, the US and Canada are among the laggards now in this, and we need to move together. Everyone has to take their fair share of the burden.
Now, what about those developing nations who kind of look at things and say, well, you know, you guys have been doing all this damage with greenhouse gas, now it's our turn?
I mean, that's not what they're saying. That's what they used to be saying before Copenhagen. You know, now China is moving ahead of almost everyone because the opportunities are enormous for them.
They're still burning coal like crazy.
Yeah, sure, but they're not building a new coal-fired power plant every week like they were last decade. The 12th five-year plan now just is a definitive shift away from that towards renewables and towards nuclear. So that's a good thing. And sure, their emissions are going to continue to rise for another decade or so, but we hope after that they'll start to decline. But look, even the poorest countries in the G20, such as India, are actually doing things. India now has a tax on coal. It has a fantastic energy efficiency program. So if India can do it, there's no reason why we can't all take our bit of the burden.
We're talking again with Tim Flannery, Australia's Chief Commissioner for Climate Change, also Director of the Australian Wildlife Conservancy and author of The Weathermakers and a new book called Here on Earth, The History of the Planet. And he'll be speaking tonight about his new book. That was last night, wasn't it?
Yeah, I'll be doing it again down South San Jose. No,
okay, you're not going to be in San Jose tonight. Are you going to be anywhere tonight?
Yeah, San Jose tonight. Yeah, I'll be down there tonight.
At the Commonwealth Club.
That's right, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
We got it right then. Let me go to more calls here. Holly, you're on. Good morning.
Yes, thank you for addressing this critically important issue again. I'm a climate policy professional, and I just wanted to make a very brief comment that I get asked all the time about whether or not I believe in climate change, because there are still some people who are skeptics. And I think that we have to really get away from framing it as an issue in what something to believe in or not. It's not a matter of whether the earth is flat or whether you believe in a certain faith. There's scientific facts. There are still uncertainties being researched, as they're being talked about in the report you're presenting today. We have to approach this as a risk issue. We buy home insurance, fire insurance, to guard against possibilities, and that's what we have to do. We have to look at this as a risk issue, not a belief issue. And there's so many measures we can take, whether a particular individual believes in the science or not, to improve our economy, air quality, energy independence, that it behooves us to do it anyway for all kinds of other reasons. Thank you.
Thank you for that statement. Appreciate hearing from you. The warming up in the Arctic is twice what it is in any other region, as I understand it. Huh?
Yeah, I think it's even more than that. It's happening very, very swiftly up there at both poles, actually. Although, you know, the higher areas of the South Pole are rather slower, but the kind of peripheral area for the Antarctic is also warming very quickly too. So that is a concern, yeah.
Let me bring more of our callers in. Michael joining us from Stanford. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm wondering, Mr. Flannery, if you have any thoughts on how the U.S. environmental community could do a better job. I mean, it's surrealist to comment from the last call, but if you have suggestions on how the U.S. environmental community could do a better job in communicating on the issue, because my feeling, I teach climate change, I'm a professor at Stanford, and I sense that a lot of the debate gets very technical and very wonkish around emissions trading. And we do fail to reach not so much the people in California, but perhaps people in other parts of the country on this issue. Do you have thoughts on how that could be managed better?
Sure. Look, I can only point to what we're doing in Australia with our new Climate Commission. We are a body that's independent of government, even though we're funded through government. We include some quite powerful voices that you may think of as conservative voices, and they include the ex-president of BP Australasia, as well as some very eminent economists and very good climate change scientists. And we go around the country talking to communities about climate change, that they can ask us anything they want, and we will give the best answer we can according to the latest science. And I always point out to people that we don't believe anything. Scientists are the greatest skeptics out there. The big problem is with people who think they know the future. The climate skeptics, who are so badly misnamed, they're full of certainty, not with skepticism. They think they know the answer.
So what do you think is going to come out of this next meeting in Greenland with the 400 scientists after this report is it's going to be handed over to Secretary Clinton, among others?
Yeah, sure. Look, I hope it'll raise awareness, and I hope that what it'll do is bring about a more integrated approach across governments to deal with this, because the one good thing about sea level rise is we've got time. We can sort of project out where things are going to go. Now, it may be we're dead unlucky and a big piece of the ice shelf breaks up and we get rapid rise, but, you know, discounting that possibility, we've got some decades to adapt. So we need to get into urban planning very, very, very carefully about this. We need to look at insurance. We need to just make sure that we're working as one to protect what we can of our coastal regions. Because
I've always thought it was a good idea. Let me thank the caller and move on to more calls in just a moment. The way they do it in the Netherlands, they have environmentalists, scientists sitting down with politicians and business, commerce people, even corporate people, and trying to come to some sense of resolve.
That's right. That's the great European means of consultation. It seems to take forever, and it, you know, us people from the newly colonized world can be rather impatient at it. But it's a very effective way of getting action. And we're trying that in Australia now. So I just say we've got to get out there. We've got to talk to local people about the reality of this.
Talking again with Tim Flannery, who is Australia's Chief Commissioner for Climate Change, and his new book is Here on Earth, The Natural History of the Earth. We'll go to more of your calls, and we'll welcome Andrew. Andrew, you're on.
Hi. I want to thank your guests, and I want to echo some of, other of your callers have worked in the eco-political world. I myself have worked in the eco-political world. And based on, my experiences, one question keeps coming up, not just from the internal side, but from, constituents and that sort of thing. What if we're too late? What if all these efforts come to nothing? Because we've already made things so bad that we can't come back from it.
I think one of the saddest gravestones I've ever seen was in Britain recently in a military cemetery. It just said he did his best. And I sometimes wonder whether that'll be my epitaph. And maybe if your caller suggests that we it's too late, at least I will have been able to say I did my best. But I think I can say more than that. I think we have got a fair chance of overcoming these problems. Sure, there are going to be impacts and there are going to be costs. But we still have time to build on the Copenhagen Accord to make sure we honour our commitments, we do what we can this decade, and we move to make sure the next commitment period, starting in 2020, sees an even steeper reduction. That means getting buy-in from the community. We have to make sure that, that we have the foundation in the community for enduring change, enduring policy reform. And that is really, really hard work. But it's what we need to do.
In the meantime, you got me very curious about the story behind that gravestone.
Yeah, exactly. Me too. I just saw it and thought,
try
I hope
best
it's not
at
mine.
What? Let me go to more calls here. And Mark, thanks for waiting. Join us on the air. You're on.
Hi, thank you so much. I have 2 points. One, a suggestion on how we approach the public, and the second is a question about the nuclear argument. So my suggestion is that there are a lot of people who still tend to not believe in the science. They're not willing to go that direction, and I find it rather fruitless a lot of times to try and go through the facts with them. So instead, I've shifted my argument to be one of economics. In other words, there's a large cost of continuing to remain on fossil fuels. There's also military costs, there's political costs, there's geopolitical situations where we involve ourselves in other governments and such that cost us a lot that are not necessarily accounted for in the cost of these fuels. I find that shift to be a lot more well-received by people who don't believe or want to believe in the science.
Sure, that's a very important thing to do. But, the other thing I think we need to do is recruit the right sort of authoritative voices in this area. And I would be looking at retired business people who understand the problem, but who, having stepped away from the boardroom, are freer to be able to speak. People who are widely known in the public. Some of your great scientists, like James Hansen, I'd be bringing them on board. Some sort of climate commission to just go around and answer the public's questions.
That's why we've had James Hansen on the program. We also had someone I know you're an admirer of, and that's James Lovelock. And the caller mentioned the nuclear. Are you with him on that? Because he feels nuclear energy really is necessary at this point to fight climate change.
Yeah, James Lovelock has a very strong opinion there. And I see nuclear, it has costs. There is no doubt about it. Every energy option does have costs and downsides. But what I can see is in places like China, they are going ahead with nuclear very, very strongly. Other parts of the world, such as Germany, have pulled back from it. And Germany, having done that, has got a real challenge. No one knows how to build an energy economy based on renewables, where I think Germany's about to find out whether it's possible. So, you know, I can see it as part of the mix. I don't endorse it. I don't advocate it the way James Lovelock does, but I just recognise the reality of the fact that it's going to be there for a number of countries.
James Lovelock said in this program he would have a nuclear facility built in lieu of a swimming pool in his home. He had that much trust in it. I wonder if you'd say that now in light of what happened in Japan.
But yes.
I'm also curious to know just how optimistic you are, because, you know, you continue the good fight here and you say you're doing your best and all that. And you give it Copenhagen a very positive spin. And like Lovelock, you look at evolution as a kind of cooperative. This is what your book is all about, a cooperative process. The ecosystem will survive and, you know, somehow humankind will prevail.
Well, the thing that's giving me the greatest optimism is we are slowly gaining the capacity to cooperate globally. And that's coming about because we're forming this almost great global civilization, a great superorganism, if you want. You could almost call it a global consciousness. And it's happening at an ever-accelerating rate through, you know, the social media. You know, there's 3.3 billion mobile phones on the planet at the moment. A lot of people have access to the internet, and that's changing the world. We're seeing it in North Africa and the Middle East, and it's giving us the capacity to cooperate in ways we never had before. So I think that we're slowly moving to a solution. It's a race against time. Whether we'll win that race or not is an open question, but my God, I'm going to give it my best shot.
Well, give your best shot a couple of emails here. Sarah in Dublin wants to know, is it possible that anyone is talking about overpopulation? Isn't that the core cause of all this? There are 6 billion people on the planet, and that number is rising. How are we going to sustain all those people, and why is overpopulation a taboo subject?
Well, it's not a taboo subject. We know there's going to be 7 billion people later this year on planet Earth. The latest UN population projections, which were just released today, were a bit of bad news. They suggest that by middle of the century we'll be at 9.3 billion and rising to 10 billion at the end of the century. But again, the answer's in our hands. What those projections make absolutely clear is if we can increase the education of women in sub-Saharan Africa particularly, and increase economic opportunity for the poorest on our planet, we have a chance of stabilising population at 8 billion rather than 9.3 billion.
And here's Marcy, who says, great discussion and very consistent with Jim Hansen's work. I looked at a Google sea level map recently to see the potential effects on Florida, where I grew up, and it was shocking. Couldn't the business community get behind this now, even in conservative states? I'm thinking of Disney, for one. Where do they stand on this? Well, it's a good question. You know? I mean, if social networks, as you suggest, have created this global village and all this interdependency, then maybe indeed everybody can get on board here. And that's, I think, your message, isn't it?
It is, and global businesses are doing that. I mean, they've been living with the emissions trading scheme in Europe for years now. They know its impact. Many of them are factoring in what they call a shadow price of carbon, so they're anticipating that they'll have to pay a carbon price in future. But they'll play by the rules of the country, and if the country doesn't regulate them or doesn't introduce a carbon market, they'll just keep going as they are, because it's, you know, it makes them less competitive if they don't.
Tim, so good to have you with us. Thank you. Onward.
Thank
Continue
you very
the good
much,
work.
Michael.
Tim Flannery. He'll be in San Jose this evening speaking at the Commonwealth Club. Again, his new book is Here on Earth, A Natural History of the Planet. When we return, we're going to get local about climate change. Stay with us. I'm Michael Krasny.